Parshas Mishpatim. The Rambam points out that Parshas Mishpatim is an unusual parsha in the sense that it goes through quite a number of mitzvahs. There are actually 53 mitzvahs in this parsha, 24 aseis and 21 los aseis. And the Ramban explains that this parsha is almost an explanation on los achmod. Recently we just had, in the last parsha we had the Aseres HaDibros. The last of the Aseres HaDibros was don't covet. But coveting means that you desire someone else's property. Before you can know what los achmod is, you have to know what someone else's property is. What makes it his property? What's my property? And therefore, to help define los achmod, Hashem gave the parsha of Mishpatim, which are basically laws of justice, laws of ownership, and most of the mitzvahs in this parsha deal with exactly that. And because it is a parsha which really goes through quite a number of mitzvahs, what I'd like to do is take mitzvah by mitzvah, a number of them, and see what kind of insights we can have from that. But before we go to that, let's begin with the first pasuk. Ve'ela mishpatim ashetasim lifnehem. These are the mishpatim, these are the statutes, but statutes meaning laws of mishpat, laws of justice, ashetasim lifnehem, that you shall place in front of them. Now, the pasuk uses an unusual expression. Normally, when Hashem tells Moshe to tell over to the Bnei Yisrael, Hashem says an expression of Vaydaber Hashem el Moshe lemor. Hashem said to Moshe to say over. Here, there are two things unusual about the pasuk. The pasuk says, these are the mishpatim, these are the judgments, these are the laws, ashetasim, that you shall place lifneim in front of them. So the first problem is, what do you mean ashetasim, that you shall place? I guess you should say that you should tell over. Rashi explains that Hashem is teaching Moshe Rabbeinu a very important lesson. Amar lo kash baruch lo Moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, lo tala daitcha lo ashan la meperek v'locha bezugam panim. Don't think that you'll suffice if you'll tell them over the halachas twice or three times until they know it clearly. That's not enough. I want you to make sure that you do more than that. Don't say, I'm not going to be matriach myself to really explain to them. No, says Hashem, you have to explain to them tami dvarim, you have to explain to them the reasons behind things, and you have to lay it out kashulchan aruch umuchan lechol fnei adam, like a table that's set in front of a man ready to eat. When the Torah uses the expression ashetasim, that you shall place, and says Hashem to Moshe, I want you to lay the table. I want you to prepare the table and make sure that it's all laid out in front of them, ready to eat. And in fact, Shulchan Aruch, which is the main body of law that governs our lives, is called Shulchan Aruch, table laid out, table set, from this very medrash that Rashi brings down. And if we think about this Rashi, I think it's actually quite interesting, because what Hashem was saying to Moshe was, don't think that you'll get away with telling him twice or three times until they know the halachas very clearly. No, that's not enough. Don't say that I'm not going to be matriach myself, I'm not going to bother myself with explaining the Tami Advarim. No, you have to explain to them the reasons behind everything. Now, you might wonder, was Moshe Rabbeinu lazy? Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't want to, you know, explain things? I believe what Rashi is teaching us is a fundamental concept. It could well be, and one would argue, that the Torah has two components to it. There are the halachas of the Torah, and then there are deep understandings, reasons behind them, and the intricacies of the logic and the entire system of Gemara and understanding. You might say, the hamon am, the average man, only needs to know the halacha. Let him know the halachas. We'll tell him over the halachas two or three times. He'll review them. He'll know what he needs for his daily life. And maybe I shouldn't be matriach myself, says Moshe to himself. Why should I trouble him? Because he's not going to understand it anyway. It's not his place. He doesn't need it. Why should I trouble myself to explain all the reasons behind all the rationales, all the logic? He doesn't need that anyway. Says Hashem to Moshe, nah-uh. That's not the way it is. You have to lay it in front of them like a table. You have to explain to them the Tamei Advarim, the reasons behind it, because for every Jew, that is a part of their Masorah, that is a part of their heritage. Yes, it's very important to know the halachas, but the reasons behind it, the depth of reason that's accessible, that's available for the Hamon Am, for everyone, it's not for the elite. It's not only for the yeshiva bocha who learned for 10 years or 20 years in yeshiva, the lumdus of the Torah, the depth of the Torah, the reasons behind are accessible and available to everyone. And I believe this Rashi is sharing with us a deep concept in terms of the accessibility of Torah for the Hamonam, for everyone, and the fact that that's the way Hashem wants it to be learned. So that explains to us why Hashem used the expression Eilam Mishpatim Shatasim, you shall place. But what does Lifnehem mean, in front of them? It should say, these are the mitzvahs that you should tell them. What do you mean that you should place in front of them? So Das Kenan brings down a medrash that's quite interesting. The Gemara makes a drasha, Lifnehem velo lifnei avodei kachavim. These mishpatim, these laws, are for the Jewish people, not for the Gentiles. And Das Kenan explains this with a medrash. He explains that Unkelus was actually a convert. In every Chumash that you'll find, almost every Chumash, the Targum that's become almost universally accepted is Unkelus. Unkelus began as a nephew of the Caesar. The Caesar at the time was Andrianus, and his sister's son was Unkelus, and Unkelus decided that he wanted to convert, but he was afraid of his uncle, and he was afraid of what his uncle would do. So one day, Unkelus goes to his uncle and says, "Uncle, I would like to go overseas, and I'd like to study business, and I'd like to ask you for advice." His uncle says, "My nephew, please, do you need money? My oats or my treasury is open in front of you. Please, whatever you need, take." "No, my uncle, it's not that I need money. It's that I'd like to study people. I'd like to get to understand people better. I'd like to go into business so I could deal with people and understand them better. Please, my uncle, give me advice. What pragmatia, what merchandise, what business should I go into?" So Andrianus says to him, "Find a merchandise that currently is devalued. Find a merchandise that right now is selling for cheap. No one understands that everything has a cycle. Buy it now that it's cheap. It won't be long before it goes up in value. And when it goes up, you'll sell it and you'll do very well." And with those words, Unkelus took leave of his uncle. Unkelus went to Eretz Yisrael, and he went to learn in the yeshiva there. And when he came to the yeshiva and he asked to learn, the Tanoim there said to him, "You cannot learn." Rabbi Lozen and Rabbi Yeshua greeted him, and he said, "You cannot learn because you're not Jewish. You don't have a bris milah, and it's not going to work." So Unkelus, at that point, was Megayer. He got a bris, went to the mikveh, became Jewish, and he began learning. He was tremendously immersed in learning. He came back to that same yeshiva, to Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Lozer, and they noticed that his face looked different. He had changed. And they said, "Obviously, Unkelus has learned Torah." Unkelus began asking them many, many questions, and they recognized that he was becoming a serious Talmud Chacham. He continued learning, continued growing, and at a certain point, Unkelus went back to his uncle. And when his uncle saw him, his uncle also noticed that he looked very different. So his uncle said, "Unkelus, why does your face look so different?" Unkelus answered, "I learned Torah." His uncle said, "Fine, so why do you still look different?" "Not only did I learn Torah, but I was Megayer, I became a Jew." His uncle said, "Why did you do that?" "Well, they told me that you can't learn Torah unless you become a Jew, so that's what I did." "Why would you do such a foolish thing? Why would you do that?" his uncle says. "My uncle, I took advice from you. You said to me, find a schora, find the merchandise that currently is devalued and eventually will rise. I looked amongst all the nations. I couldn't find a single nation that was as mevuza, as embarrassed, as ill-treated as the Jewish people. And I know in the future they'll be lofty because they're God's holy people. I took your advice, my uncle." Andrianus was so impressed with Unkelus' logic that he took his hand and he slapped Unkelus in the face. "You could have learned Torah, you didn't have to be Megayer." And says Unkelus, "I could not have. Magi dvarav liYaakov, chukav mishpatav liYisrael. Torah is only accessible to Jewish people. A goy cannot learn." Explains the Das Kenim, that's what the pasuk means. Eila mishpatim eshatasim lifnehem. The Torah is not just the Yerusha, not just the inheritance of the Jewish people, but it's in front of the Jewish people that it's accessible, that it's available. If you have a neshama of a Jew, you can delve into the Torah, you can understand it to its depth. If not, it won't work. And I believe that this Das Akenim is sharing with us a profound concept. Because I believe we'd be hard-pressed to find a man more intelligent than Unkelus. Unkelus wrote Targum. The role of Targum is to take all of the meaning of the Torah and take the very essence of it and translate it into a different language. It requires knowing Kol HaTorah Kula. Many words in Hebrew cannot be translated. Many words in Shema, for instance, cannot be translated because they carry too many nuances, too many different variations and shades of meaning, and they cannot be translated into a different language. Yet Unkelus had such profundity, such a grip of Torah knowledge, that he was able to define the essence of each pasuk and translate it into Aramaic, and his Targum became universally accepted because he was a profound Talmud Chacham. So clearly, he was a very, very intelligent person. Number two, Unkelus was very motivated. Keep in mind the fact that his uncle was the Caesar. His uncle was mighty, his uncle was powerful, and anything that Unkelus needed, he could easily get from his uncle. He was born to a life of riches, luxuries, power, and privilege. And he gave it all up. Why? Because he saw the truth, and he pursued it. So here's the question. If Unkelus was so brilliant, and he was so motivated, why couldn't he have remained a goy and learnt? Why do you have to convert? He comes to the Tanoim, and they say to him, it won't work. Magid Dvarav L'Yakov, it won't work. Why not? He's brilliant, and he's super motivated. Why can't an intelligent person sit down and learn the Mishpatim? These are laws. These are tort laws. These are laws of civil engagements. There's nothing so absolutely abstract about this. Why can't a Gentile learn this? And what the Medrash is sharing with us is that while there is a surface level to every Mishpat, to every halacha in Chosh Mishpat, there are layers and layers of depth behind it, and there's tremendous amount of profundity that you cannot access unless you have a neshama that's ready for it. Hashem wrote the Torah with tremendous depth behind it. Every word, every sentence, every nuance contains layers and layers of depth, and you need a neshama that's receptive, that's able to understand it. And the reason why Unkelus could not have learned Torah as a goy, it was not because he wasn't smart and not because he wasn't motivated, but because he didn't have the kelim necessary. He didn't have the tools. He wasn't a receptacle for the Torah because he had the neshama of a guy. He had to become a Jew. Once he had a different neshama, now there was a receptivity. Now he could plummet the depth. Now he could dig in and really understand because now he was ready for it. And I believe the lesson for us is actually quite interesting. Because what it means in plain, simple language is that every Jew is receptive to the Torah. I have a neshama that's ready for it, and I can access it. So I believe what this pasuk is sharing with us is, Eila mishpatim asher tasim lefneihem, says Hashem to Moshe, don't think that it's enough for the Hamon Am to know the halachas. Don't think you'll say it to him twice or three times, and he'll have it down pat. That's not enough. They have to know all of the depth, all of the profundity. They have to know Shas and Poskim. They have to delve into things and fully understand it. And they're capable. Why? Because they have a neshama of a Jew. They're receptive. It comes to them naturally. And therefore Hashem outlines to Moshe how it is that he should give over the Torah to the Bnei Yisrael. Now, what I'd like to do is go through a few of the mitzvahs in this parsha and see if we could learn some of the lessons from it. And we'll sort of skip, because there's no, excuse my expression, no storyline per se, because it's from mitzvah to mitzvah, but let's go one by one and see what we can gain from it. The pasuk says, Make ish v'meis mos yumas. If a man kills another man, he is put to death. That's a concept of a mazid killer. If Reuven intentionally, with warning and witnesses, kills Shimon, he's put to death. He killed b'mezid. He killed intentionally. He's chayev misa. He's given a capital punishment. Vashelot tzada. However, if he didn't intend, a different case. If Reuven didn't intend to kill Shimon, velokim ina liyado, and Hashem brought it about, then that's a different story. And here we have the introduction to the concept of a shogeg killer, one who killed unintentionally, who sent it Ayin Miklat. So if Reuven killed intentionally, he's chayav misa, he's obligated to be killed. It was mazed intentionally, he's killed. However, if he did it unintentionally, then he's sent to the Ayin Miklat. He has to run to the city of exile, and there's an entire parsha that explains to us what happens. Hashem wants to protect him. Hashem doesn't want to allow the Goel Hadam, the avenger, to kill him. So we have to set up Ayin Miklat. We have to set up different cities. There has to be signs there. There has to be food there. All of his needs have to be met to protect this shogeg killer because he's innocent. He doesn't deserve to die. And therefore the Torah goes well out of its way to make sure that he's protected. However, what's interesting to note is how the Pasuk says it. The Pasuk says, Vashalot Tzada, if Reuven did not intend, Velokim Ina Liyado, and Hashem brought it about. And Rashi says, what does Ina mean? Ziman Liyado, Hashem prepared it. Meaning, what happened if Reuven didn't intend to kill Shimon, but Hashem set him up for it? Hashem prepared it. He didn't aim the gun, he was shooting out somewhere, and Hashem arranged, orchestrated, that Shimon should be right in the path of the bullet. Then, oh, he's a shogeg killer, he goes to Ayin Miklat. And Rashi is bothered by the problem. Why would Hashem do that? Why would Hashem set him up for failure? Reuven didn't intend to kill Shimon. Why would Hashem Zimen prepare it that he should kill him? So Rashi explains that this is a concept of Megalgalin Schusai De Zakai. Hashem brings about good things through good people, V'chol Vaydei Chayev, and bad things through bad people. Explains Rashi that this is what the Gemara in Makkos refers to, where actually what happened was there was a history before we met these two individuals. These two individuals each had an event happened in their life that caused them to be brought together in this moment. Reuven had sometime earlier killed another man, Bishogeg, unintentionally, but he was negligent. He was chopping wood, something of the like, and the handle flew off. Had he been more cautious, he would not have been chopping wood around people, but he wasn't. He was chopping wood, the handle of the axe fell off and killed a man. He's a shogeg killer who deserves to go to Ayin Miklat, but no one saw him. And he didn't report this, and he thought he was going to get away with it. Shimon, again years earlier, was involved in a situation, and he killed a man intentionally. He pulled out his knife, stabbed the man, killed him. But again, there were no witnesses. So Shimon as well thought that he was also going to get away with it. Years later, Hashem arranges that these two individuals should meet. Shimon is under a ladder, sitting there, resting. And Reuven happens to be walking up the ladder. And Reuven, as he's climbing on a rung, falls onto Shimon and kills Shimon. Witnesses see this. Shimon, who had killed earlier intentionally, is killed. Reuven, who's climbing the ladder, he had earlier killed unintentionally and thought he got away with it. He now is witnessed by people falling, killing Shimon Bishogeg. Then we're going to send this Reuven into Golos because that's what he deserved either way. Perfect justice is meted out. Shimon deserved to die because he killed. And Reuven deserved to go to the Ayin Miklat, to the city of refuge, because he killed unintentionally. And that's exactly what happens. They meet again. Shimon is put to death. Reuven is sent to the city of refuge. And Rashi explains that that's what it means, that Hashem arranges for this event to happen. And the only thing that's curious about this is that one should ask the following question. This Reuven fellow doesn't sound like a particularly great guy. Originally, he was not careful. He was careless. And he acted in a way that the Torah considers him a person who has to leave the regular life. He can't lead a life of a regular man. He has to go into exile. He has to leave. He did that thing earlier, and he didn't report it, didn't tell anyone. He thought he got away with it, and he was hiding. Ad kidei kach, to such an extent that Hashem has to arrange for him to get caught red-handed, and so he'll be sent away where he should be. If so, why is the Torah so concerned, oh, make sure that the shogeg killer is protected, make sure there are signs on the road, make sure there's enough food and water for him? The man is a killer, albeit an unintentional killer, but he's a killer. Why is the Torah so concerned for its benefit, so concerned for its good? And I believe the answer to this underscores the entire concept of punishment in the Torah. Hashem is all-powerful, and Hashem doesn't need any help. And Hashem doesn't have to take revenge. The Rishonim explained to us that if Hashem were ever angry at a human being, if Hashem could theoretically get angry, Hashem wouldn't punish the person. Hashem wouldn't bring a nuclear explosion to vaporize the person. Hashem would cease infusing energy into that person, and that person would cease to exist. Hashem is koyochol. Hashem is the energy source of all of physicality. There's nothing that could violate the will of Hashem, and there's no need for Hashem ever to get angry. Any punishment in the Torah is out of rachamim, out of mercy. You've damaged yourself. You've sullied yourself. If you were to die now, it would be a terrible thing. Why? Because for eternity, there's a black mark in you. For eternity, you would suffer. The punishments in the Torah, whether it be Malkus, whether it be Misa, all of the variant punishments in the Torah come out of chesed, out of kindliness, out of goodness. Why? Because it cleans up. It's not retribution in the sense of paying back, or justice in the sense of some wrong has been meted out and it has to be paid back. It's merciful, it's good, it's kindly, because it allows the person to get rid of part of what he had done wrong. And as a matter of fact, the Rishonim explained to us that Gehenim is the same. When a person dies, unless they're a great tzaddik, likely they'll spend a certain amount of time in Gehenim. It's not God's wrath. It's not God punishing the wicked. It's a huge chesed, a huge kindliness. Why? Because what I shape myself into, I am for eternity. Whatever great things I've done, I enjoy for eternity. But whatever things I've done wrong are with me forever. Gehenim is a time period that allows me somehow, some way, to get rid of some of those flaws, allows me to polish the diamond a little bit, and it's a tremendous chesed because it eliminates those things that otherwise would have plagued me for eternity. And I believe with the Shogi killer, that's exactly what's happening. Hashem doesn't need to mete out justice because otherwise he'll get away with it. It's merciful. And Hashem gave punishments in the Torah because Hashem loves the Jewish people. And if you've done something to sully yourself, to dirty yourself for eternity, it's a part of you. There's a kapara process, there's an atonement process that helps remove the sin, helps clean you up, and the Torah is concerned. And even if you're not concerned, and even if you try to run away from it, Hashem makes sure to arrange it that you'll meet and he'll meet. Everything will be just, not just because Hashem is seeking vengeance, just because Hashem loves the Jewish people and wants for them the best to happen. And therefore Hashem arranges these things to occur as they occur. Let's move over to another concept in Perek Chof Beis, Pasuk Lamed Zayin. Ki yivnog ish shor oseh, if a man will steal a cow or a sheep, utvacho mochro, and he will either slaughter it and sell it, chamisha bok ishlam tachat ashor, he has to pay 5 bokor for the shor, varbos son tachat oseh, and 4 sheep for the sheep that he stole. So this is a famous sugya brought in the Gemara. If a man steals a sheep or a cow and he then eats it, the halacha is that he has to pay dalet v'hei. But let's understand exactly what the Torah is saying. If a man steals a cow, then and he's caught, he shechted it, he can't return the object, he has to pay 5 times that cow. They estimate the value of that cow, and 5 times that amount he has to pay back to the owner. However, if a man stole a sheep and ate it, again, he can't pay back the sheep because the sheep is gone, and then he pays 4 times the sheep's value, estimate the value of the sheep, and he has to pay back 4 times that animal to the original owner. Rashi's by the discrepancy. Why is it that a cow you pay back 5 times the value, and a sheep you only pay back 4? Rashi brings down Amar Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, name of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Chasa Mokom HaKvodu Shel Brios. Hashem had mercy on the honor of creations, on the honor of man. Shor Sholach Baraglov Leizbanabo Ganav. The shor walks, and therefore the thief isn't embarrassed when he steals him. However, a sheep, the ganav puts on his shoulders. When a man steals a sheep, he reaches under the sheep, puts it on his shoulders, and runs out the door. He's embarrassed. Therefore, he only pays four. Why? Because he already suffered. He was already embarrassed. So Rashi's telling us the reason behind this is because when the man stole the cow, he walked out clean. He just put a rope over around Elsie's neck and just walked out. But if he stole a sheep, he suffered embarrassment. For a human being, a dignified person, to put a sheep on his shoulders and have to put an animal on top, it's not nice. It's he already suffered. The Torah says, listen, he suffered already. He doesn't have to pay back five. He already suffered some pain. He already suffered some punishment. He only has to pay back four times what he stole. My Rebbe, the Reshiva Zatzal, asked a very penetrating question on this Rashi. And that is, we're dealing with a ganav, a thief. The man is not thinking about the embarrassment to his nobility and his dignity. He's thinking about dinner. He's thinking about the fact that this sheep is going to be delicious and wonderful. He's putting it on his shoulder because he's thinking about the money he's going to make. He's not focused on the dignity. He doesn't care. He cares about one thing, getting out of there. So why is it that his amount that he pays is lessened? And Shiva Zatzal explained to us that a human being has a very fine nature. A human being is dignified, a human being is honorable, and even if he no longer lives up to those standards, and even if the way he conducts himself now is not that way, there's a pain deep down within him, subconsciously he feels it, and Chas HaKadosh Baruch Hu Hashem says, oi, he may not feel the pain, but I know it's there, it's deep down within him. There is a pain. He may not sense it, but it's there. And Hashem says, I can't punish him the full amount because he suffered already. And Rashi Zatzal stressed to us how sensitive HaKadosh Baruch Hu is to the pain of a human being, how much Hashem loves human beings, and how that comes into Mishpat. Even though what we're dealing with here is judgments, and judgments are not supposed to have issues of mercy enter into it, Hashem felt that it's not right. If you steal a cow, you didn't suffer embarrassment, pay the full amount. But if you stole a sheep, you had to put it on your shoulder, you had to suffer embarrassment, even though you didn't necessarily feel it consciously, it was there within you, and Hashem factors that in so much that it lessens the actual amount, and you only pay four times. And again, it's very illustrative of the love and mercy that Hashem has for us and the system of judgment that's called Rachamim, and understanding that the Torah is Rachmana. The actual title of the Torah used by the Gemara all the time is Rachmana, referring to mercy, which is also one of the acronyms, one of the titles used for Hashem. Let's move over to the next pasuk, Mechashefa lo sechaya, a witch you are not allowed to keep alive. The halacha is that if a person practices black magic, if he's male or female, doesn't matter, but if he practices black magic, he's chayev misa, he's put to death. Now, let's understand what this pasuk is saying and what's happening here. In our world, we have something that's very commonly known as optical illusions. A person will stand up there and pull a rabbit out of his hat, or he'll make an object disappear. What he's doing is sleight of hand. You know and I know what he's doing. It's achizas einayim. He's tricking the eye. It's smoke and mirrors. It's really just pretend. And what he's doing is, it's called magic, but it's just fanciful movements and very clever use of mirrors and etc. That's not what the Torah is referring to. Achizas einayim is not usur. Optical illusions are not forbidden. The Torah is referring to black magic as in real black magic. Not making a rabbit seem to appear, but actually making a rabbit appear. Not making an object disappear, seemingly, but rather really making it disappear. And the Sefer Chinuch explains to us this mitzvah and explains to us why it is that this person is chayv misa. Explains the Sefer Chinuch that every physical component in this world has a spiritual counterpart. There's nothing in the physical world that can exist without a spiritual component behind it, guiding it, telling it how to act, keeping its parameters in existence, and the sustenance of all physicality is a spiritual counterpart behind it. The sun, the moon, the stars, the earth, rocks, rivers, all have a spiritual dimension to them that keep them about, that sustain them. There is a certain knowledge, which modern man does not have, as to how to play with the upper worlds, how to move the spiritual worlds in such a way that it changes the physical world. Water is liquid and odorless, colorless, because the spiritual part of it commands it to remain that way. If one were fully skilled, knowledgeable in the art of Mechashefa, of black magic, you would know how to manipulate the spiritual parts. And once you manipulate the spiritual part, the physical dimension that's manifest from it changes as well. A Mechashefa is one who's schooled in the arts of navigating and manipulating the spiritual world to make changes in the physical world. And the reason Sefer Chinuch explains why the Torah is so treats it as such an egregious sin is because Hashem created a world in perfect order. We're not supposed to graft apples with other fruit. We're not supposed to do these type of things because we accept, as the Sefer Chinuch explains, we accept the fact that Hashem created a perfect world with all of mankind's, with all of the animal kingdom's needs met. And when you graft an orange and a tangerine, what you're doing is you're changing the world. You're allowed to eat it and someone else does it, and as a Jew, we're not allowed to do it. Here, this is far deeper. Here, what this person is doing is going into the spiritual dimensions that Hashem created to maintain the physical world, and that person is manipulating the spiritual dimension thereby changing the physical world. He's negating that which Hashem did. Hashem created a perfect world with order, harmony, and balance, and he's messing with creation, and it's so egregious that it's Mechashefa lo sechaya. He loses his lease on life. And I think for us, the interesting point is to recognize how much more sophisticated the world is than we recognize. We look at ancient man who would bow down to totem poles, and we look at them as fools and silly primitives. But as the Rambam explains in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, idol worship had a deep and profound meaning behind it. Originally, they weren't just bowing down to rocks and stones. They were serving the spiritual components behind the physical. Hashem gave the sun and the moon a sar, a malach, some spiritual force that keeps it doing what it's doing. And that spiritual force has control, and people would serve it originally for good intention, originally to serve Hashem, and then later changing it. But the point being that it's serving the spiritual world, or trying to manipulate the spiritual world in a way that Hashem doesn't want. And again, understanding that that's what Avodah Zarah is, understanding what Mechashefa is about, lets us get an eye glimpse into the entire spiritual dimension to the world that we don't normally focus on. Okay, let's move on to the next mitzvah. The next mitzvah is that if you loan a Jewish person money, you should not take interest. Loan him money as a favor. Loan him money because he needs help, and don't demand interest from him. Now, there is a concept of a business loan. A heter isker is used in a situation of business, meaning to say if one needs capital to begin a new venture, that's not a private loan. What the Torah is referring to is when I run out of money. I have bills to pay, I didn't anticipate, and I'm stuck. And I go to my neighbor and I ask him for money, please can I loan money? He's asking you for a favor, don't demand interest. Interest is cutting, he's already in financial trouble. If you're going to demand interest, what's going to happen is trouble is going to become more deeper. Have a relationship of chesed one with the other, loan them the money and don't ask for interest. Again, a business loan where I need money for an investment, for capital, Chazal recognized that there was such a need and they created something called a heter isker to allow that under the exact parameters and way that Chazal set it up. But other than that, in a normal situation where one neighbor comes to his friend for a loan, don't charge interest. In addition to that, there are a number of other things you shouldn't do. What if you loan money to someone? Reuven loaned money to Shimon, and then it came time for the payment. The 30 days of the year was up and was supposed to be paid, and Shimon doesn't have the money to pay. Reuven says, pay the money. Shimon says, nope, I don't have it. Sorry, I'd like to. Reuven is allowed to take a mashkon. He's allowed to take something as collateral to ensure him of the fact that Shimon will eventually repay. However, the Torah is very specific and very exact. If you take his clothes, make sure that he has it back. If it's his night clothes, make sure each night you bring it back. If it's day clothing, make sure that each day you bring it back. Don't allow him to go without his cloak, without his coat, says the Torah. Waiki kasus lavada, that's his only cloak. He simlosu laoru, that's what's going to keep his flesh covered. But meyishkav, what is he going to lie down with? Because if you do this, if you take his night garment and don't return it at night, or if you take his day garment and don't return it the day, vahayak yitzak elai, and it'll come out that he'll scream to me, says Hashem, veshamati, and I will listen to him, ki chanun ani, because I am merciful. But chanun is an interesting expression. Chanun is unlike rachamim. Rachamim is a system of mercy that's somewhat justified, somewhat proper. Chanun is free mercy, without reason, without cause. And Hashem says, be careful. If you act in a cruel manner to a poor man, and he calls out to me, I'm going to hear his cry. Why? Because I am chanun, says Hashem, even if he's not justified. Explains us, Funo, in that case, Shimon, of course, is wrong. Shimon borrowed money from Reuven. It came time to pay up. Shimon didn't have the money, so Reuven said, fine, give me a collateral. Reuven is 100% justified in taking that collateral. And let's assume that Reuven took the man's bedding, took his blanket, and at night didn't return it, and there is no complaint against Reuven. Reuven is justified in din. He's 100% correct. Choshemishpat, the laws of justice, would say, Shimon, you owe him money. He has a right to take the blanket, the bedclothes, as collateral. Shimon has no claim, no taina in Beis Din. However, says Hashem, that may be true here, but I am chanun, I'm merciful. And I'm merciful even if it's unjust. Even if it's true that Shimon is wrong, but if he cries out to me and I see a poor man, I see a poor man who's crying out to me and you're the cause of it, Hashem says, I'm going to listen. And the Koch Ve'or explains to us that almost if it could be one of the liabilities of Hashem's rachamim, is that sometimes it works against us. The Koch Ve'or explains that if you oppress a poor man, if you oppress a widow, Hashem says, I'm going to listen to them and I'm going to act in a cruel manner. Why? Because I feel their pain. And I feel the pain, says Hashem, and I'm going to react to it, and I'm going to act b'chari af, I'm going to act with anger, because the rachamim of Hashem allows him to feel the pain, if it could be very, very acutely of an oppressed person. And the result is, if you're the person causing oppression, you will be responsible, you'll be accountable, and oftentimes the reactions are very strong and very dangerous. And it's a very important idea to keep in mind before we act so arrogant and so flippant about oppressing people, whether they be poor people or just regular people. You know, in any social situation, it's very easy to oppress someone, very easy to embarrass them, very easy for a person to feel slighted or just not able to defend themselves. And it's hard to know how far the Rachamim Hashem goes, and it's very, very important to be ever cautious and ever careful because, again, if you cause a person pain, if you cause a person embarrassment, if you oppress them in whatever way, if they call out to Hashem, Hashem may listen to them, even though they're not justified. As the Sforno says, even though Shimon in this case was 100% wrong, he has no complaint, no taina, but if he's now lying without clothing at night and he's freezing and he calls out to Hashem, Hashem, I don't have, Hashem will have mercy on him and it may come back to haunt you. But there's one more line that the Sforno puts in that's so interesting. Sforno says, in this case, what's going to happen? Explains the Sforno that it may well be, Reuven, that the extra money that I gave you to support other people, I'm going to take away from you. And says Hashem, don't oppress Shimon. You know why? Because I gave you extra money to support other people, and if you act in a cruel way, I may very well take that away from you. And the Chovos Avava shares with us a profound concept. He says there are different reasons why people are given money. Some money is given to you to take care of your needs. Other monies are given to you to take care of your family's needs. And other monies occasionally are given to certain people to allow them to support other people, people in the community, people outside the community. But explains the Chovos Avavos that it was given to you for a purpose. And he explains that people make a mistake. They assume that every penny is theirs. Every penny was given to them. And if they wouldn't give money to tzedakah, if they wouldn't support poor people, they would be rich. But never, I have to give it away. Explains the Chavos of Avos that often Hashem will give you that money specifically because Hashem knows that you're a good person and allows you to get the merit of supporting others. But if you don't use the money appropriately, you won't get it. Hashem will arrange that you won't have it anymore. And I find this very interesting on a number of levels. I once, not that long ago, was speaking to the executive director of one of my children's yeshiva, and I was sort of discussing with him the large tuition expenses and the obligations upon the average person to come up with a fortune of money. At which point he turns to me and says, do you know, if you take your children, all your children through all the school years, take all the tuition you're going to pay for them, if you would have all of those dollars together, you could buy a helicopter. And it's true. If you're a person with a family and you have children who go to yeshivas, you're going to pay a fortune of money over the years. A fortune. And oftentimes, there's a sense of, wow, Baruch Hashem, I'm doing well, making a lot of money, and I'm able to pay tuition. Baruch Hashem, maybe even full tuition. It's great. It's wonderful. Boy, if I didn't have this heavy burden of tuition, you know how rich I'd be? You know how wealthy I'd be? Hashem, I hope you appreciate that I'm giving up for you. I'm giving up all this money, all my wealth, I'm giving up for my children's Torah education. And if it could be Hashem sitting there and saying, listen, uncle, it's very good that you're giving money for your children's Torah education, but didn't you listen to the Gemara? The Gemara says, Kol mizunoso shel adam ketzuvin lo. The exact amount of money that you have to make this year is set, except for money that you spend on Shabbos, money that you spend on Banav L'Talmud Torah, your children's Torah education. And those areas of Shabbos, Yontif, and Torah education, if you spend more, you're given more. If you spend less, you're given less. Let's say you decided, Yankala, you don't want to send your kids to yeshiva. You'll send them to public school, and you'll pocket the money. You'll keep it in the bank. You're making a mistake. You're not going to get it. I'm only giving it to you for this purpose. And if you don't use it for this purpose, you're not going to get it. So does that mean if I use it for a purpose, it doesn't come back for me? It's not on my cheshbon? Oh, no. If you use it appropriately, you're given the schus, you've spent thousands, 10,000, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars to teach Torah to your children, and that's your eternal merit. But if you don't use it for that, you won't have it. So again, it's illustrative because, again, sometimes you hear of parents who attempted to put their children in different yeshivas or take them out of yeshiva even because who could afford the tuition? And if you knew that spending money on their tuition is the greatest opportunity in your life, obviously you're benefiting your child. But if you're afraid that it's costing you, you're making a mistake. You're forgetting who runs the world, and you're forgetting that there are provisions and conditions to your wealth. And what the Sforno is sharing with us is that oftentimes Hashem will allow a person to be the benefactor. If Hashem puts you into a position where you can benefit others and you can give money to tzedakah, say the words, thank you Hashem for allowing me to be in this position. Now obviously you have to be financially responsible and you give miser, maybe chomish if you're wealthy, 10%, 20%. There are limits on how much money of your annual income you're allowed to give away if you're very wealthy. It's 20% if you're a regular person, 10%. But when you have the opportunity to give that amount, whether it's 10% or 20%, you should know and understand that those are monies that Hashem is giving you, affording you the opportunity to buy your world to come. Hashem is allowing you to be the rich man to keep the poor man alive, and it's considered as if you gave him life. You're able to support those Torah institutions. You're able to do with your stucco money great things. And it could well be that if you don't do those things, you won't get it, you'll lose it. So it's a win situation, and if you don't, it's quite the opposite. And I believe that's what the pasuk is telling us here. Let's move on to the next pasuk. The pasuk says, Anshe Kodesh Tiyun Li, you should, a holy people you should be to me, Ubasa Basad Trefel of Sechelu, a animal killed in the field you shouldn't eat, Lakelv Tashlichoso, throw it to the dogs. Here is the halacha of treifus, that if an animal is killed, if an animal, a sheep, for instance, is killed in the field, it's called a treifa, you're not allowed to eat it. What should you do with it? Lakel tashlichoso, throw it to the dogs. Rashi explains, why is it throw it to the dogs? Why don't you just say burn it or use it for leather or whatever you might want to use it? Why is it specifically throw it to the dogs? Explains Rashi, limdcha kosu the Torah's teaching you, she'ena kodesh baruch hu mefakeach schar kol piriyah. Hashem does not hold back reward from any creation. Any creation that does what's good, what's right, what's proper, is rewarded. What does this mean? The pasuk says, when the Bnei Yisrael left Mitzrayim, Not a dog barked. Normally, there'd be a tremendous uproar. Malach Mavis was out that night. The Jewish people were leaving. The next morning, there should have been a tremendous uproar. The dog should have been barking. It was silent. Not a dog barked. And it was a much more clear Kiddush Hashem, much more Biyad Rama. It added to the glory. Therefore, says Hashem, because the dogs didn't bark, I'm going to give them their reward forever. The Jewish people, when you have an animal killed in a field, give it to the dogs, pay them back for what they did. They were quiet then, they didn't bark, they made a Kiddush Hashem, give them their reward forever, they'll get the treifas. Now, this Rashi is very difficult to understand. Why? Because Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu, told the Klai Yisrael that this was going to happen. When the Jewish people leave Mitzrayim, there will not be a dog that barks. And the reason why Hashem wanted it to be that way is because Hashem wanted the Jewish people to leave Biyad Rama, with glory, with fanfare. And if Hashem arranged it, that the dog, which is normally reactive, the dog that normally barks, shouldn't bark. But you see, here's the point. The dog doesn't have free will. The dogs didn't have a meeting of the dogs and say, guys, should we bark or not? Well, let's think about it. Well, Hashem doesn't want us to bark. Should we, shouldn't we? There's no debate, no discussion. Hashem arranged it that the dogs shouldn't bark. Not because the dogs chose not to bark, not because they thought about it. So why did they get reward? Forever remember the goodness that the dog give, forever give him the trefa. Dogs didn't have free will then, didn't make a decision. Why should they be rewarded? And I believe the answer to this question requires a very, very deep understanding of systems that we don't normally think about. When Hashem created the world, there were two systems that were in operation. Originally, Hashem thought that if it could be to create the world with Midas Adin. Din means justice. Justice is very simple and very direct. You're held accountable, you're responsible. If you did X, no mitigating circumstances, no questions. If you did X and Y came out for it, you are responsible, you are accountable. However, if it could be, Hashem saw that the world could not exist, because Din is extraordinarily exacting and extremely demanding. Din says that anything that comes about, you're held fully accountable for, fully responsible. And any human being who would be under that microscope of extraordinary precise din wouldn't make it. Even the Avos, Sar Imenu, who's judge Bedin, lost 28 years of her life. And Hashem saw that no human being could be omed Bedin, could stand complete, absolute justice. Therefore, Hashem introduced something called Rachamim. Rachamim, loosely translated as mercy, says you have to factor in where was a person coming from, what were their intentions. Are they having a good day or a bad day? Do they fully understand the gravity of the situation? What Rachamim does is introduces many mitigating circumstances and criteria into the judgment. It says, yes, Reuven did action A, and yes, that caused this and this, but he didn't realize it was going to come about. He didn't realize that this was going to be, so you can't hold him as responsible. But the Mesillas Yesharim explains to us that Din is in operation, and Rachamim, there's always a balance. There's always a balance. Sometimes Hashem acts with more mercy, and sometimes with less. Oftentimes, our tefillah is to ask Hashem to change the balance. Maybe I didn't change. Maybe what I did before didn't change, but the system of judgment changes, and introducing more rachamim can have a tremendous effect. And it almost never happens that we are subject to absolute din. But din does exist, and when we leave this earth, we stand in front of din, and din is something that actually continues to operate in the world. And if you'd like to see the, almost I'd say, the good side of din, it's exactly over here. You see, from what the dogs did came out a tremendous Kiddush Hashem. From these dogs not barking, there was more glory given to the Jewish people, more glory given to Hashem. Look at that. 3 million people march out of Mitzrayim, the nation that never allowed a single slave to leave, and an entire nation walks out from it, and not a dog barks. The guard dogs, the watchdogs are always there, always ready to pounce, sit there silent, quiet. Now, granted, the dogs didn't have a choice, but through them came a much greater Kiddush Hashem. Through them came more glory, more honor, and on a certain level, it comes back to them. Why? Because absolute din demands what came out from you, you're accountable for. From the dogs came out a great thing. From the dogs came out Kiddush Hashem, and there's reward coming to them. And I believe what Rashi is sharing with us is a fundamental concept. Because you see, the truth is that during our lifetime, there are going to be many actions that we've done that are good, but might have had a little bit of, not such great parts to it. But what Rashi is sharing with us is a fundamental idea. If I did X and something good came about it, granted I wasn't the biggest tzaddik, granted maybe there were kavanas in it for my own honor or glory, whatever, from me came out something great, it comes back to me, it comes back to my credit, and it's something that's mine for eternity. And again, while din has a harsh side to it in the sense that it demands accountability for what we've done wrong, it has a beneficiary side in the sense that whatever we've done right, even if our kavanas aren't perfect, we still be rewarded for, we still receive back on our cheshbon. Okay, one more mitzvah that I'd like to finish up with. The Torah says, Lo sevashal gedi b'chelev imo. Do not cook a gedi, a goat, b'chelev imo, in the milk of its mother. Three times in the Torah tells us, don't cook a gedi b'chelev imo. Chazal tell us it doesn't mean a gedi, doesn't only mean a goat. It means any animal, and it doesn't only mean the milk of its mother. It means do not cook any meat in milk. Do not cook it. Do not derive benefit from it. And do not eat it. And this is the halacha of basar b'chalav, of meat and milk. And if you think about this halacha, it's a bit curious. It's a full loss to say that if you cook meat and milk together, or if you derive benefit from meat and milk cooked together, or certainly if you eat meat and milk cooked together, you're over losasay, you violated a full law in the Torah. Now let's understand this halacha. The meat has to be kosher. The milk has to be kosher. To qualify as basar b'chalav, it has to be kosher meat cooked in kosher milk. So here's the question. Keep them separate and they're both great. The meat is kosher and the milk is kosher. Mix them together. Oy vey! Yechayv malchus. What happened? The meat was kosher, right? The milk was kosher. Cook them together, boom, you blew it. What does this mean? What's pshat? And this is something that we call a chok, and we're supposed to, I guess, you know, certainly when you're younger, they tell you we can't understand, it's beyond human understanding or something like that. The Chovos Avovos in Shara Avos Elokim says it's not so understandable, it's not so mystical. He says it's actually quite simple. He explains that when Hashem created man, Hashem made man out of two distinct dimensions. Within me, there are two diverse natures, two very separate parts. Within me, there is a chelik elokim imal, a pure, brilliant neshama that only wants to serve Hashem, that only wants to do what's right, what's good, what's proper. Within me, there's a desire to serve Hashem, a desire to help other people. Within me are all the instincts to be a great human being. And within me, there's another part. There's a nefesh bahami, an animal soul, with drives and appetites, needs and desires. And if you'd like to understand that other part, the nefesh bahami, all you have to do is go into the animal kingdom, and you'll find that every animal has all of the instincts, needs, and desires imprinted into it to keep itself alive. The robin hungers for the worm. The cat hungers for the mouse. The bear is instinctively drawn to the berries that feed it, as well as the salmon that it just loves to eat. But not only does Hashem give each animal instincts, Hashem gives them the aptitude, the ability, and the intuition to know what it is that they should use as their food source. Within the animal soul, Hashem imprinted all of the needs to keep itself alive and bring the next species into existence. And this is called the nefesh habahami. An animal is alive. An animal has a nefesh. It doesn't have a neshama. It doesn't have a seichel. It doesn't have that cognitive, conscious eye that thinks and deliberates, debates, and decides. There's no anochi. There's no I in the animal. But there is a live, vibrant part within the animal. A number of years back, I wrote a book which I primarily wrote as a Kirov work. It's called The Torah Lifestyle. And I had an interesting experience because I wrote this about the Nefesh HaBahami, the animal soul, and the Neshama within man, and the balance and the fight back and forth. And I was, a number of years after I'd written the book, I was giving a shiur somewhere in Long Island, and a woman came over to me and says, "Rabbi, I have to thank you. I read your book, and you have no idea how much it helped me. Rabbi, I can't thank you enough." Now, if you've ever been involved in any kind of kirov, or certainly if you've written, you know that's very gratifying to hear that your words have been received, that they helped. However, I later found out that it wasn't quite as I had assumed. You see, someone explained to me what she meant. She had recently lost her dog, and she was broken, and she couldn't be consoled. And then she read in the Torah Lifestyle that an animal has a soul. So she said to herself, "Great! Fido and I are going to meet again. Hopefully many years from now we'll meet again, and forever we'll be together." Now, the reason why I say that did not bring me great joy was because it's patently false. When Elsie the cow dies, her nefesh evaporates. Hashem gives it a vibrant life part to keep it alive. And once it's dead, it's smoke, it's gone. The other part of me, the neshama, lives on forever. But I, whom speaking to, am comprised of two diverse parts. There's a part of me that's pure seichel, and only wants to do what's good, what's right, and proper. There's another part of me that's akin to any other nefesh in the animal kingdom. The bear, the tiger, the lion has a vibrant life part. Sometimes it almost looks like a dog has personality. It certainly forms attachments to its master. It certainly has a sense of loyalty. It doesn't have deliberative cognitive skills and abilities. It doesn't have an anochi. It doesn't have its own agenda, but it acts and imitates something like thought because it has a nefesh. Within me, there's also a nefesh. Within me, there's a nefesh of Bahami with all of the drives, instincts, and desires. And I, whom speaking to you, am comprised of these two parts, and these two parts are fighting for primacy. Whichever one I exercise becomes stronger and becomes more dominant. If I give in to my animal passions, that part becomes stronger and stronger until it vanquishes my seichel. If I hold down the animal part and follow my seichel, follow my pure neshama, I grow and accomplish, and the nefesh bahami becomes weaker. And explains the Chovos Vavos, this will allow you to understand many, many of the mitzvahs in the Torah. Many of the mitzvahs in the Torah, Hashem warns us about because they will give an inordinate amount of strengthening to the nefesh bahami. If you eat basar b'chalav of meat cooked together with milk, it strengthens the nefesh bahami. Now, you probably have to be a scientist of the soul to recognize how it does what it does, but that it does it, explains the Chovos Vavos, is a fact. And it's similar to things that we're involved in. If you ever notice, you know, if you're nervous or antsy, or if you're agitated or maybe even irritable, the first thing that might be recommended to you is stop drinking caffeine. Because caffeine affects your moods, affects your irritability, affects the way you feel. Now, how could that be? I feel differently. I'm different. I just had a cup of coffee, two cups of coffee. Why? Why does it make me jittery and nervous? And the answer is there's a real effect of my body upon me because I'm made of two different distinct parts, and because there's a connection between my neshama and this nefesh bahami, I'm affected by different things. I get tired and cranky and groggy. If I drink too much alcohol, I become drunk. If I drink too much caffeine, I become jittery and anxious. And the Chovos Vavos shares with us that many, many of the mitzvahs of the Torah were given specifically to warn man, don't do these things because they'll give an inordinate amount of strengthening to the nefesh bahami. If you eat basar b'chalav, Chazal tell us, tree foods are metamtim alev, they deaden the heart. I've seen this in many situations. I'm certainly no novi, but I oftentimes can tell when a person eats tree food, there's a heaviness to the heart. They can't hear things. It doesn't penetrate. It doesn't get through. Because again, as Chazal explained, tray food is metamte in the heart. It deadens the heart. When you go to the dentist and he gives you Novocaine and you walk out of the office, you have to be careful not to drool because your lips are still numb and you don't even notice the saliva. So you have to be careful. Novocaine deadens the lips. You don't feel anything. Tray food deadens the heart. And if you eat tray food, it's harder to feel Hashem's presence, harder to feel the holiness of Shabbos, it makes it more difficult for you to become a holy person. Many, many of the mitzvahs in the Torah are exactly around this point, and explains the Chovos Levavos, that's shatnez, that's many of the forbidden relationships, and certainly it's Los Avashal Gediba Chalev Imo. It's a chok in the sense that it requires a tremendous understanding to recognize how it functions in the human soul, but function it does, and explains the Chovos Levavos, the reason why the Torah warns us not to have meat and milk to cook together, because Hashem created man, Hashem created spiritual forces, warns us that these things will damage us and make it more difficult for us to serve Hashem properly.